Now Trending with Andrea Elias and Orla Johannes on CJAD 800.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Orla.
And I'm Andrea, and we hope you're enjoying a wonderful holiday season so far and are having a great final day of 2023. How hard is that to believe?
I know, right?
It's crazy. Anyways, like many of you, Orla and I are taking some time off this week to spend time with our families, so we've decided to revisit some of our favorite interviews with some of the great guests that we've had on the show over the past few months.
That's right. On today's show, we'll catch up with fashion designer Christopher Conn, and we'll tell you how allowing your kids to be bored isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Plus, Harvard University nutritional psychiatrist Dr. Uma Naidu will join us to discuss her new book, Calm Your Mind with Food, A Revolutionary Guide to Controlling Your Anxiety. But first, we spoke with Dr. Heather Lynch, a professor of brain sciences at Texas A&M University, about her recently published research about the benefits of anger last month. It's interesting stuff. Have a listen.
How many times have you felt angry about something, and then somebody tells you to focus on the positive? Well, many of us have been taught to push away those negative emotions, but according to new research, a healthy dose of anger has its upsides. According to research recently published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, anger can be helpful at motivating people to overcome obstacles and meet their goals. We're now joined by Dr. Heather C. Lynch, the lead author of the study and a professor in the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department at Texas A&M University. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lynch.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
So tell us about your research and how you discovered the helpful side to anger. I'm very, very curious, very interested.
Sure. So there have been theories for decades that anger should be helpful when we encounter situations that involve challenges and obstacles to our goals. And there's been previous studies showing that anger is motivating, that it makes people feel powerful. And we wanted to go that next step and see if anger could result in better outcomes when we're facing challenges.
So tell us a little bit about the research that you did and how and what the conclusions are that you came to.
Yeah, so we used an experimental approach. So we brought people into the lab and we assigned them to different emotion conditions. So some of the people were assigned to feel anger, some were assigned a neutral condition and other emotion conditions. And then we engaged them with a task after that that involved some kind of obstacle and some kind of goal. And then we assessed if people in the anger condition did better in attaining their goal and compared to the other conditions. And that is what we found with a variety of different goals and a variety of different types of obstacles. Anger did result in better outcomes compared to the other conditions, but it was really only helpful when there was a challenge or an obstacle to goal. It didn't really help when the situation was easy.
Oh, isn't that interesting? So the next time that we're feeling anger, what can we do to help use that emotion to our benefit?
So emotions, including anger, are always signals that something important is happening, something that we care about is being affected in some way. And so they're always a good, when you feel that signal, it's always a good time to stop and think about why you're feeling that way and figure out how to respond.
Yeah, it is incredibly interesting because, you know, when you start to feel angry, some people aren't mindful enough to know to stop and tailor their response. For example, if they're angry with their children and they're going to start yelling at them, or if they're angry with somebody else and they're going to be violent. Like, what needs to happen in between that emotion and that response to tailor it to their benefit?
Yeah, so one of the important takeaways from our research is that it really matters what your goal is when you're experiencing anger. So you could imagine that you're in an argument with your partner and you have a goal of improving your relationship, then anger might motivate you to express your needs and maybe reach a compromise with your partner. If your goal in the argument is instead to prove yourself right, anger then could motivate you to belittle your partner, to insult them, to ignore their views. And the first goal is probably going to improve your relationship. And the second goal is probably going to hurt your relationship. And so I think really thinking about what you're trying to attain is very important when you experience any emotion, but especially anger.
Yeah, because there's some people, you know, experts, doctors that do say don't even get to the point of anger. If you become too angry, you're not going to solve anything. So what do we do with all this conflicting information?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that the intensity matters a lot as well. So we were studying people who were moderately angry. So in one of the studies, as an example, they were in a computer program that kept telling them they were wrong, even though they were giving the right answer. So that's the type of level that we were, of anger that we were dealing with. They weren't feeling rage. They weren't intensely angry.
They were annoyed.
Yes. If you're too angry, it's going to dysregulate you. You're going to be too aroused.
So, you know, anger is a perfectly normal emotion. I think pretty much everybody, right, feels it at some point. But we've all been in that situation where you're angry or annoyed by something and somebody is telling you, you know, focus on the positive. And it's almost like now I know we talk a lot also about toxic positivity, right, where you're not being given that space to be angry. So what is it that makes us so uncomfortable with a perfectly normal emotion like anger?
Yeah, so there are probably two parts to this. One is that it feels bad, right? So when we feel what we call negative emotions like anger or sadness, they're not usually fun to experience. They feel aversive. And then the other part of that can be cultural. So there are some cultures or families where certain emotions are seen as destructive, and anger tends to be one of those. So anger in a lot of cultures is perceived as destructive and dangerous for relationships. And so in those cultures, you do receive a message or in those families that to suppress your anger and not to share it.
You're listening to Now Trending. I'm Orla alongside Andrea, and we are chatting with Dr. Heather C. Lench, the lead author of a study talking about the upside of anger. Dr. Lench, let me ask you, for somebody listening right now who has experienced somebody else's anger, let's say, for example, a spouse, they become angry and then they become violent. For them listening right now, trying to turn anger into a benefit of positive, what would you say to them? Because they might not be seeing what is being said here at all.
Yeah, well, if there's violence, you know, people have to protect their safety first and foremost, and should seek assistance if there's violence involved at any time from anybody. If people are expressing anger, I think it's important usually to remember, in cases where there's not violence, to remember that they're expressing to you with their anger that they care about the topic. And so if you are in a relationship with them, the anger can be a sign that this is something important, right? This is something important to the relationship, important to the partner, that's probably worth discussing and trying to work through.
Dr. Lench, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time and an excellent study. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Heather Lench, a professor of brain sciences at Texas A&M University. Coming up, fashion designer Christopher Kahn. But first, a look at the roads.
Now trending with Andrea Elias and Orla Johannes on CJAD 800.
Welcome back. I'm Orla alongside Andrea, and thank you so much for joining us this New Year's Eve Sunday for the best of Now Trending. As we look back at some of our favorite interviews over the past few months, we really enjoyed catching up with Canadian fashion designer Christopher Kahn a few weeks back. Take a listen. Chris Kahn is a Montreal-based designer since 1997. Zenith, a family business in handbag manufacturing, founded by his father, Nick Kontogiannis, led to Chris launching his brand Christopher Kahn Bags in 2001, which gained popularity and has been seen on celebrities such as Nicole Kidman and Princess Madeleine of Sweden. Chris is on the line and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, Orla. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
Nice to be with you guys.
Well, this is quite surreal for me because 20 years ago in Montreal, when I was on CTV, I also interviewed you. I mean, we were babies back then, Chris.
I know.
When I was fashion reporter on Entertainment Spotlight on CTV. And here we are. And you're still in the game because your product was top notch.
I'm still doing this. This has been my life's work. And it continues to be.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Now, I know the industry and the market has changed immensely over the 20 years. So tell us how Chris Kohn Bags has evolved.
Well, the evolution is interesting because we went from Christopher Kohn and felt we had an opportunity to service a much bigger and broader part of the community. So we launched Kolab in 2007, which was our vegan leather bag line. And it couldn't have fallen at a better time because that's when there was sort of a shift in consciousness and a lot of people really wanted to move away from leather in that segment of the industry. And it was just onward and upward from there because we had very strict mandates in terms of what we were looking to build over the next, you know, at that time, few years. And the mandate was really cruelty-free, the top vegan materials that we can get our hands on, and then working to get it PETA approved and then begin our recycled initiative. So now Kolab, all these years later, is 98% of the collection is made with recycled fibers on the outer materials and the linings. And we're PETA approved vegan, and you know the business continues to grow. So we're very happy with that.
There's obviously been a societal shift as well, you know, in that period of time. How much has interest and demand for these bags grown from your point of view?
Well, I think most people are looking for this, and even for the ones that aren't necessarily, the demand is huge. I mean, anything, look, PU bags are vegan just by what they are. They're not made with animal products. But I think when the consumer finds out, oh, they're vegan, oh, they're recycled, they're, all of a sudden, there's a much bigger interest because now there's a lot more involved. We're talking about carbon emissions, we're talking about waste and all of these things. So we're trying to mitigate all of these problems. And, you know, it's just small steps with long-term big impacts. And I think everyone's on board for that, really, at the end of the day.
You're listening to Now Trending. I'm Orla alongside Andrea, and we are chatting with Chris Kohn from Christopher Kohn Bags. He's on the line joining us now. So, Chris, is there a lot of competition with the high-end brands that are not sustainable and products like yours that are?
Well, there's always going to be a lot of competition. I think what the higher end, there's not a ton of high-end brands that are really focused on vegan other than Stella McCartney. But I think everyone's shifting to more sustainable practices. So instead of really focusing on bringing out like a ton of products per year, they're going to focus on a couple of products, have them be their signature items, and then work on just producing those rather than just really going too far away and producing all kinds of different products that at the end of the day, most people don't want anyway. There's always going to be a small percentage of the bags that are the it bags for every brand. And that's what people are going to really gravitate towards. So I think in that area, that's where they're mainly focusing. In terms of direct competition for us, we do have a lot of players in our segment. There's no question about it. I think what sets us apart, though, is that we're really invested in the recycled portion of our business, whereas a lot of our competition is not. They are doing vegan, they're doing it well, but we're really, really committed and invested in our recycled initiative.
How much more difficult is it to manufacture a sustainable bag like yours opposed to, you know, just something that another designer is putting out there?
I think the biggest issues we have is finding the quality product. So the material itself has to be of phenomenal quality for us to use it. Because the recycled initiative is still fairly new, you're not finding a lot of mills that are able to produce the best quality materials. We have a couple. Our material, I would say, is over and above what I think other people are doing. And then the bottom line is the cost. So the cost really comes to us. We want to still have a very competitive and interesting price point for our consumer, which gives a branded product with somewhat of a value proposition. So the cost comes at us because most brands will get a relatively good material and then mark it up like crazy. We're sort of middle of the road in terms of the markup, where we really just want to show value. That's so important to us. And that's also part of our language about giving back. We're giving back to our customer at the end of the day.
Chris, what's trending for fall right now?
What is trending for fall? Well, we've got fur, we have shearling, we have the baguette is still showing strong in terms of styling. We still have the sling bags that are showing strong. Little small soft cross bodies. This is sort of what's trending. And in terms of colors, we've got soft blues, we have burgundy, we've got like a toffee color, caramel colors in terms of our colors. But there's a big push on smaller crossbody bags, light, convenient. That's where things are going.
And when you say fur, I'm assuming fake fur, right?
Yes, of course. We use vegan fur and vegan shearling.
Chris, I love the fact that you said pale blue for fall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Andrea's all over the pale blue, like pale blue.
No, we need to hook you up, Andrea.
No kidding. Because, I mean, traditionally, we would think of the lighter colors for more spring, summer, right?
Yeah.
Well, look, it's not, listen, I'm not talking about baby blue. This is more, we call it sea salt. So it's kind of like a medium colored blue, but it's very, very far away from what you would typically imagine with a navy and everything. It's sort of like middle of the road, but it's a stunning color. And I'll send you some pictures that you can look at later.
Yes, please.
Now, Chris, your bags are sold worldwide. Tell us about some of the celebrities wearing your bags right now.
Well, the pita bags, honestly, I wouldn't even know. I'm sure there's people around. We're not up to date with what's going on in terms of a celebrity with Colab at this point. But we are in some of the best retail locations that you can find. And also, you can find the biggest selection of our products on our website, www.colab.ca. It's co-lab.ca.
Fabulous. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you guys very much.
That was Canadian fashion designer Christopher Conn. Coming up on the Best of Now Trending, why letting your kids be bored this holiday season might not be a bad thing. But first, the latest from the CTV Montreal newsroom.
Now Trending with Andrea Elias and Orla Johannes on CJAD 800.
Welcome back. I'm Andrea, and there's Orla. And thank you so much for spending part of your New Year's Eve Sunday with us as we look back at some of our favorite moments from the show over the past few months. Many of us have had our kids home a lot in recent weeks, which means you've likely heard the words, "I'm bored," a few times at least. So we thought now would be a timely moment to revisit the recent interview that we did with neuroscientist Dr. Cindy Hovington from The Curious Neuron about why allowing our kids to be bored might not be a bad thing.
So, I mean, I would just love to be bored. I'm too busy to be
right?
bored. I crave to be bored. I crave to be bored right now.
What's that even like?
I know, right? So why is allowing our children to be bored so important?
So I would actually rephrase that and say, why is it important to allow them to feel bored? So it's not really about being bored, but it's an emotion. And we don't see it that way, but it's an unpleasant emotion, which means that's similar to feeling angry or feeling sad, where we teach our kids how to cope with it and how to move past it. We have to coach our children through boredom so that they learn how to experience it, how to feel it and sit with boredom, but then also how to move past it in a healthy way.
That's so interesting. I had never looked at it that way, Cindy. Why do you think it is then that we're so uncomfortable with the feeling of being bored?
It's one of those unpleasant emotions. And if we search, you can Google Ruler by Mark Brackett, and he has a book called Permission to Feel. And boredom is in that category of unpleasant emotions. And we tend to want to push these unpleasant emotions, whether it's sadness or anger, like I said before, even worry. Boredom is one of those unpleasant emotions. And it's so easy in today's world to push that emotion of, or that feeling of boredom, because we have media, social media, we have phones, we have iPads. So in that moment where a child tells us, I'm bored, it's easy to feel that void and to fill it with some entertainment, some form of entertainment. But we have to really be mindful of how we're, or how much space we're creating to let our child feel bored, because in those moments of boredom, they're going to learn how to cope with that emotion, but also build really important skills like internal motivation, which is what we want them to have in school. But it comes from those moments of boredom where they allow themselves to be curious and to let themselves, you know, find something to do and be creative. And that's where all the resilience comes in. So boredom is such an important part of a child's life.
Wow, that's so interesting. So the benefits of being bored is to create creativity in our kids. How can we translate that to them, though, when they say when they say that they're bored? I'm like, let the creativity flow. How do we translate that message, Cindy?
Yeah, I would break that down into preschool kids or school-aged kids, right? So in preschool kids, they're smaller and they're still learning how to regulate their emotions, which is what boredom is. So minimizing the toys in their environment, minimizing the screen time when they're feeling bored to try to create moments when they can be bored, and using open-ended toys. And when a very young child is bored, just saying, what else can we do here? Let's play this, or maybe you can try that. And not always being beside them, but guiding them. You're their coach. If you have an older child, it's a little bit different. And there you can create more of a goal with them. If the goal is to find a 30-minute block of space on Sundays where they're bored and you don't do anything with them, right? Like, they have to figure it out. What are the baby steps you can create, right? Like, what are they interested in? What can they Google and start searching online if they want to use the internet? You know, what is it that we could, can they find the link between when they're bored and how they're behaving, what their thoughts are? And yeah, so the link between their emotions, their thoughts, and their behaviors. So if they're bored and they just come to see you and their behavior changes and they're whining and they're upset, what are their thoughts in that moment? Is it that boring sucks? Because that might be what they're stuck on. And if they're stuck on that thought, it's hard to move past that emotion. So what if you change the feeling to, or the thought to, when I'm bored, I get to do whatever I want and search whatever I want or learn about whatever I want. How do you change that?
It's interesting because when I say no iPads in the car, I say, imagine, why don't you look out the window and see where you live? See what's right on the street. Look at the people, you know?
Yes.
And you know what? Well, when you give them that idea to actually open their eyes and see the world, they do actually, it's interesting for them, but because I think they're so, you know, captivated by their iPad and looking down, they forget there is so much more out there. And, you know, when they first tell me I'm bored, and I say, look out the window, you know, it does open up their minds.
It does. And that's exactly what you're doing. You're coaching them through it. So telling a child just to go play usually doesn't work, or, you know, looking out the window gives them a bit of a guidance, or playing I spy with little kids. I've been doing that with my kids since they were very young.
Yes.
When we're in the car, or can you find something blue, or can you find something red, to keep it really simple for them. That's the sort of coaching I'm talking about. And eventually they'll figure it out on their own. Now my kids are a little older and they create their own games. And that came from the ability to be curious and to be bored in those moments. So that's the coaching I'm talking about.
It's so true. And I'm just thinking about my own son. You know, we have the no electronics in the bedroom rule in our house. Mm-hmm. And he's an early riser. And he's not allowed to come into our room until 7:30. And the time, like, sometimes he's up, you know, for 2 hours in the morning. And the things that he does and the level of creativity just from being alone in his room and, you know, the drawings and the artwork and
yes,
the things that he comes into our room to show us that he's created in that period of time is incredible. So right, Cindy, how do you know when it comes to the boredom, what's okay and what's too much? Because we obviously don't want them to be like climbing the walls either.
No, and you do want to gauge your child as well. So I love what you said, because I noticed that with my daughter as well. We learned how much she loves drawing through those moments of boredom. You can have a child, also a child who's neurodivergent. So a child who has ADHD or who's autistic might struggle even more with boredom. And they're going to look for ways to kind of fill that void with sensation. So they might want to climb things or put things in their mouth. So if you're noticing that kind of extra like sensory seeking behavior, you do want to speak to your doctor and maybe get a little bit more help with this. But besides that, you just want to coach your child and be by their side, acknowledge that boredom isn't pleasant, but to show them that it is part of life. And if we can guide them through that and sort of make it a little bit more comfortable for them, then in school, there's moments where they're bored. We all experience moments of boredom in school, but research shows that if a child is able to cope with boredom, they're able to motivate themselves a little bit more in school and achieve higher grades and do well. So we do have to keep doing that with them.
How much of the aspect of boredom is about independence? Because I know I have an only child, and I know when he's bored, you know, he'll go through that, I'm bored, and then he'll come up with something to do. But often it's something he wants me to participate in. Like, do you want to play a board game or chess or something like that? Like, is that still allowing him that space, or is it really something he needs to be doing on his own?
So there's a balance in it. They don't like being bored the whole day, and then being alone the whole day would be very long. But with a child, especially under 10, you want to kind of guide them and balance that between moments of you playing that game, but then stepping away. If you do have a child who's in school and they can't spend 20, 30 minutes on their own, then I think you have to start creating baby steps. Like, how do we get to those 20, 30 minutes? Let's start with 10 minutes, 15 minutes. But I don't expect a child to be able to be bored and entertain themselves the entire day. You know, 30 minutes to an hour is very good and healthy under 10 years old.
How important is it for a parent to sit with their child and do something together? And how long should we be doing that for to benefit the child?
It's very important, but at the same time, we don't expect, you know, a parent to be there for 3 hours by their child's side. So on weekends, I really suggest that parents balance it out. If you have half an hour in the morning, what can you do with your child? Can you color with them? Go for a walk, whatever, depending on their age. But do that first. Create that moment of connection with your child. Because when you connect with your child, it's much easier to disconnect from them and that they can be alone and feel comforted. So do the connection piece first, and then step back and see if they could, with whatever they have around in their environment, play on their own, whether it's with Legos or color. But a child who's under 6, the time is a lot less. You want to start with baby steps, 10 minutes on their own. So it's always balancing between being with them for a few minutes and stepping back. And on weeknights, I know half an hour is not possible, but 10 minutes of playing a card game makes a huge difference in how they can spend their time alone.
Cindy, as always, we really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much.
That was Dr. Cindy Hovington from the Curious Neuron blog. Coming up on the Best of Now Trending, can food help to manage your anxiety? But first, a look at the roads.
Now Trending with Andrea Elias and Orla Johannes on CJAD 800. For all
anxiety. Welcome back. I'm Orla alongside Andrea, and we're so happy that you could join us on this New Year's Eve as we take a look back at some of our favorite moments from the show over the past few months. We enjoyed our recent conversation with Harvard University nutritional psychiatrist Dr. Uma Naidu about her book, Calm Your Mind with Food, A Revolutionary Guide to Controlling Your Anxiety. Take a listen.
Hi, doctor. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. This is incredibly interesting. So chapter one in your book is Fighting the Global Anxiety Epidemic. What is the anxiety epidemic, and how do we know if we have anxiety?
You know, a clinician can help you assess whether you have anxiety, but some of the ways that you may feel are a sense of anxiety, just panic, waking up with a pit of worry in your stomach, feeling nervous and jittery when you get up or at different times of the day that come on without a precipitant, your heart racing, your palms getting sweaty, being short of breath, things like that. So there are lots of specific symptoms that a clinical psychiatrist or provider can help you decide, but I think that those are some of the telltale signs. Now, the reason or, you know, speaking more to the global sort of epidemic of anxiety, it also was heightened during and after the pandemic, in part because there was so much going on in the world. But anxiety has always been at the forefront of mental health problems, certainly in the United States. And in fact, we know that it has increased significantly after COVID. You know, my focus is on trying to help people find other ways to calm their mind and help the anxiety. And one of the ways is how we eat and through the lens of nutrition. It's one of a whole sort of protocol and plan that I talk about, but it's one thing that many people, many of us just overlook.
Dr. Naidu, what do you believe then is the connection between mental health and what we're eating?
One of the biggest things that evolved in the last two decades is the gut microbiome and the science of the gut-brain connection. It turns out that these two organ systems, you know, we don't necessarily associate the gut with the brain, but we know now through research and science that the gut and brain originate from the exact same cells in the human embryo. And then they divide apart to form these two organs that remain connected by what's called the vagus nerve, which is our 10th cranial nerve. And that vagus nerve allows for like two-way text messaging between these organ systems. And that text messaging is really often neurotransmitters like serotonin and others, which we know are impacting mental health. But then we also have learned and understood that serotonin is not only located in the brain. About 90 to 95% of serotonin is located in the gut as well as the receptors. Now, there are certain mechanisms that have to be involved to transport it to the brain, but the fact that it's located right in the same location where our food is being digested was really powerful and helpful information for us to help understand nutritional psychiatry and help unfold how one of the mechanisms of how this occurs.
It's very interesting because in a lot of, you know, brochures or literature I'm reading that I did a lot of in the last few years because my dad died of Parkinson's, gut health is being linked with so many neurological diseases and a lot of other diseases. It's just incredible how we're hearing so much more about gut health. So when it comes specifically to anxiety, are there certain foods that you would recommend people avoid if they do suffer from anxiety?
Yeah, you know, the issue is often that we are consuming things like added sugars without realizing it. And it's not that sugar on its own is bad. We eat sugar in fruits. We have it broken down from different foods that we eat in natural forms. But it's really the added sugars, the high fructose corn syrup, the sodas and things like that. So let's start with that as a big category because that's not a surprise to people, but I want them to understand is many savory foods like salad dressings, ketchup, store-bought pasta sauces contain a lot of added sugars in them. So that's a category we want to be careful about what we're consuming and those added extra sugars. You know, soda, energy drinks, all of these contain a very large amount of sugar as well as caffeine, both of which may actually drive anxiety in a lot of people. Another large category is those processed, ultra-processed sort of junk foods and fast foods. Those have a lot of unhealthy fillers, ingredients, food stabilizers to make them last long. And those foods, you know, the way that they break down in the gut is detrimental. The breakdown products are more toxic to our gut. So that's a category you want to start to scale back on and move towards just healthier whole foods, actual foods that you recognize. Another category is artificial sweeteners. It's a broad category. There's some newer ones which have some promising research. But for the most part, the ones that are found in diet soda and, you know, lots of things that we eat as low sugar or no sugar, these are actually very disruptive to the gut microbiome. And that's a huge category that we want to step back from. And another category, there are quite a few, but another category is industrialized oils that we are now using to cook our foods. We really want to move towards just extra virgin olive oil and avocado oil, those types of oils, rather than the seed oils and the industrialized oils that are used, say, in fast food restaurants that are more economical, because those drive a process called inflammation. And inflammation is one of the biggest drivers for what really sets us up for anxiety in the body.
So on the opposite end of the spectrum, let's talk about some good foods that we should consider adding to our diets if we are looking to ease our anxiety.
Well, I want people to think about actual whole foods. So adding in those vegetables, those berries, as many different colors of foods, textures of foods, different types of vegetables, different types of food, a couple of servings of, say, berries a day. All of these bring a very important nutrient called fiber. By adding in vegetables and these and another category of whole grains, and by whole grains I mean healthy whole grains, things like quinoa, amaranth, different grains that we eat that are actual grains, adding in a small portion of those along with a hefty portion of those vegetables, which carry fiber, is a very important nutrient because these foods break down very slowly in the gut. And because they break down slowly, they really have a very even effect on our blood sugar. They don't spike our blood sugar or have our insulin react when, say, we have a sweet donut or a sugary type of candy bar, something like that. And that helps keep us metabolically more in sync, and we are therefore calmer over time just by eating in a healthy way. Another building block to tap into are spices. Spices are very powerful because they're sugar-free, mostly calorie-free, and if you just buy pure spice, they can be added in for flavor, but they have very powerful antioxidant and anti-anxiety properties. Some spices are turmeric with a pinch of black pepper, capsaicin, mint, and several others. These are things that we can start to add in that really help us to feel calmer. Another category is teas that are often overlooked. Things like green tea can be very calming. Passion flower, lavender, chamomile. These are ways that you can get started on just incorporating beverages and foods into your diet to really move away from the processed foods, add in these healthy foods, and really start to settle down your inflammation and calm your mind.
Dr. Naidu, we have about 60 seconds left. Not only are you a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, but you're also a professional chef. And your new book, Calm Your Mind with Food, A Revolutionary Guide to Controlling Your Anxiety, offers some fantastic calming recipes. Can you just share a couple of the titles with us before we have to let you go?
Yes, I have a very exciting recipe for eggplant, but I use Mediterranean recipes where I use eggplant, but I use spices from the from South Asian cuisine and make it kind of an interesting, flavorful dish that people would enjoy. And you can use those spice blends on many other foods. Another one is a super colorful salad that I call a kaleidoscope salad that I will share the recipe in my book. And it's just something that you can have on a regular basis that will help help with that fiber that you need for your gut, but help you over time to eat more whole food.
Dr. Naidu, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Harvard University nutritional psychiatrist Dr. Uma Naidu. And thanks so much for taking this trip down memory lane with us. Hope you and your loved ones are having a wonderful holiday season so far. And thank you for making Orla, myself, and CJED a part of your lives this year. We look forward to being back with you next Sunday at 2 p.m. for our very first show of 2024 right here on CJED. In the meantime, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Now Trending Show. Have a great week.